This is a Fusion View podcast, and I am Yangmei Ui. A few months ago, I was commissioned by Mislexia, the quarterly journal for women writers, to write an article about the writer as entrepreneur. Now, when we think of writers, we usually see them sitting quietly in a room, scribbling away or typing away at their stories. Or we picture them taking long, solitary walks, like Daphne du Maurier striding across the Cornish moors. Writers are solitary types, loners, deep thinkers. They aren't suited for a life in the marketplace, buying and selling, haggling, negotiating, publicising. Or are they? In the increasingly competitive publishing market of today, it's getting more and more difficult to get your book published, especially if you are a first-time novelist. At the same time, the technology is now available for enterprising writers to self-publish their books. And many writers who have found the conventional publishing route closed to them have taken up that opportunity. But once you've got your pile of printed books, all 10,000 copies of them, sitting in your hallway, what do you do with them? What does it take to shift your stock? Do you have the skills and energy to turn from writer into business person and get out there to sell your books? Can you ever make a profit? My article for Mislexia magazine explores what it takes for a writer to become an entrepreneur. I interviewed three self-published writers and a book retail insider, Scott Pack, as part of my research for the article. I've uploaded the email interviews of two of those writers, Julie Noble and Mark Blaney, onto my blog at www.fusionview.co.uk. You can also find there the email interview with Scott Pack, who was the buying manager at Waterstones, the UK book chain, and is now commercial director at the Friday Project. This podcast is a recording of my telephone interview with self-publishing legend Prithi Nair. Prithi took on a fictitious persona in the form of publicist Prue Menon to publicise her self-published novel, Gypsy Masala. She was so good at the job, she was shortlisted for an industry award for Publicist of the Year. Prithi tells us her story in her own words in this special Fusion View podcast.
Gypsy Masala was essentially about following your dreams and also in following your dreams, facing your fears. Because I think when you follow a dream, you also inevitably you face all your fears. And I wrote it because I was working as a management consultant in the city, and I was really unhappy in my job, and I just kept thinking there's got to be more to life. There absolutely has to be more to life. And so I revisited a childhood dream, which was to become a writer.
And so it's a very personal book, because you were writing about your dreams while trying to fulfill your dreams.
Absolutely. Personal in the sense that it's not my story and it's not my family's story, but the emotion and the expression of that emotion, as in why we're here, what is it that we essentially want to do, why don't we do the things that we long to do. And so it was addressing those kind of questions.
And when you finished writing it, did you find that you had addressed the questions, that you had found the answer for yourself?
That's a difficult question, because little did I know what would have to happen in order for that dream to kind of materialize. But in writing the book, I actually felt a lot of the things that had been going around in my head had come to some sort of conclusion.
Mm. And how did you find the time to write the book? Because management consultancy is quite a full-on job, isn't it?
I used to work from about 9 o'clock till 7 in the evening, so I used to write on my way to work on the tube.
Oh my goodness.
And write on the way back, and every single spare moment I had, as in the weekends and the evenings or the early in the mornings, I wrote. So I had no social life, had no life for about 3 years.
In that period of 3 years, while you were doing this, it must have been completely exhausting.
It was exhausting, but it was also very invigorating. I felt for the first time I had a purpose. Mm. Although I went to work and, you know, I had some sort of purpose in going to work, I never felt fulfilled. But in writing, there was a sense of fulfillment that I didn't get from work.
Mm. And did your friends and family know at the time that you were writing this in all your spare time?
I mean, a couple of friends had a vague idea that I was writing, but they didn't actually know what I was writing. I just sort of said, oh, because it wasn't a big thing. It was just, it was almost sort of just getting my thoughts out. So, and they knew that I was writing because I was never out or never go out with them. So it wasn't like I said, oh, I'm going to write a book and this is my book.
Mm-hmm. And can you tell me something about your family background?
Okay, so I was born in Kerala, and I came to England as a small child. My parents moved from Kerala to London in the 70s. And so I grew up in the east end of London, and I moved to North London when I was about 8. My father always wanted me to become a lawyer, so I remember my first experience of reading, as in the book, the first set of books that he bought me was the Encyclopedia Britannica, and he actually sat us down, my brother and I, and he would tell us all about the rule of law.
Oh my goodness!
And in training to become a lawyer, because they had suffered such as first generation immigrants, they had suffered such hardship and instability. Didn't want my brother and I to go through the same. So they wanted us to go into stable careers and stable professions.
I think that's very, very typical and understandable for that generation, wanting their children to have stability so that they, the new generation, doesn't have to suffer what they suffered.
Absolutely. And I think for first generation immigrants, it was all about survival. I mean, it was all about putting food on the table, making sure that you were clothed and fed and could get off to school properly. But for our generation, second and third generation migrants, it's all about, okay, they've achieved that. It's all about following your dreams and making the full potential of almost in a sense your parents' experience, your grandparents' experience, because they are so totally different from your own experiences.
Yes. So now, did your family know you were writing?
No, I mean, I was always artistic, so I was either always painting or writing. So it wasn't like I had given up one thing to do the other. I was always writing, or I was always painting, or I was always creating things. So it wasn't like suddenly it had become a question of I was just writing.
Mm. So you were working very, very hard at work, and you were using all your spare time over 3 years to do this thing.
Mm.
And at the very end, when you finished writing your novel, you gave up your job. That was quite radical.
It wasn't quite like what had happened was I'd got two-thirds through Gypsy Masala. I'd written two-thirds of it, and I reread it, and I thought, and this is just going to sound so immodest, I thought, oh, this is actually quite brilliant. And I thought, I want this to be published, because initially I didn't write it to be published. I wrote it to sort of expel certain things I had going on inside of my heart, inside of my head. And I reread it. I thought, some of this is quite beautiful. And I wanted it to be published.
Mm.
And as part of my job, it was to coach people to take leaps of faith. Not necessarily huge leaps of faith, but little leaps of faith towards the direction of their dreams or towards their goals. And I felt that's what I needed to do. And I don't know what came over me, but I felt it needed a radical leap of faith. I just wanted time and space to complete the novel, give 100% to the novel. And so hence I walked into work and I handed in my resignation.
That must have felt so liberating.
It was, but it was one of those bizarre moments where you don't really think about it, and then after you've done it, you think, oh my God, what have I done? So in the interim period, I sent out my manuscript thinking, you know, two-thirds of it, thinking it would be snapped up by a publisher, because why wouldn't it? It was absolutely brilliant. So working out my notice period, I was waiting for this manuscript to be accepted, but it pretty much came back rejected from near enough every single publisher, bar one, and the one was from HarperCollins, and the lady who wrote to me said, it's magical writing, it's not for us, but good writing will out in the end. So that kind of got me thinking. I thought, okay, and then came that huge moment of regret where I just desperately wanted my boss to ask me to stay, and I want to say there was a moment of madness. I didn't mean to kind of give up work over this following your dream business, but I wanted her to ask me to stay, and she didn't.
Mm-hmm. So So it was quite a difficult, shocking period for 3 months. You sent out how many publishers did you approach?
I didn't realize at the time, and I wish I'd done more research, but you don't know these things, but there is a system to sending out manuscripts, and you don't just send them out to publishing houses. You find an agent, and there's a whole process, and there's a whole network of contacts. But because I didn't realize that, I just sent them out cold to publishers, and possibly, I don't know, 10, 15 rejections.
Mm-hmm. And so every time the envelope came back, your heart must have sunk a little.
Yeah, because I knew it was like it had come back with the manuscript; it hadn't come back as a letter.
Yes. But I want to come back to your self belief, which you just now said, "Oh, that was very immodest to think it was brilliant." But I think that is one of the key elements in succeeding. That having this kind of self belief, and perhaps having it even in the face of everybody else saying, "You know, what are you doing?" And do you think that you were able to hold on to that, which then launched you into your next step when you started getting all these rejections?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the biggest irony of the situation was that it was my father who instilled self-belief in us, because my father came from absolutely nothing. I mean, he came from a rural village with nothing, and he worked his way up. And he did it by just sheer self-belief and sheer determination and hard work. And he taught us that if you focused with the end in mind, you could pretty much achieve anything.
Mm-hmm. So, okay, so with this self-belief, what did you do next?
I couldn't bring myself to tell my parents that I had given up work. So, and I had every intention to tell them, of telling them. But when I got home, I couldn't do it. I just, you know, I'd packed all my stuff up and I just couldn't do it. So, couldn't do it over dinner, couldn't do it over breakfast. And so then put on a suit and pretended to go to work the next day. And the suit routine lasted perhaps 4 weeks, or if not longer. I can't actually quite remember the time. But I would go to the library and I would think of all, my job as a management consultant was to find solutions to problems, creative, sometimes very creative solutions. So I applied that to my own situation. So I wanted to become a novelist. I knew the end outcome. I wanted to be a successful novelist, translated into different languages, possibly have one or several of the novels adapted into television or film. And I looked at where I was currently, which was a manuscript that had been rejected by every single publisher. And then I thought, okay, this is where I'm at, this is where I want to be, how do I get there? And I came up with this very, very, very simplistic idea, and it was, I will self-publish this novel, I will make it incredibly successful, and then I will sell it to a big publishing company. Now, it was as simple as that, and articulating it as simply as that, but I had no knowledge of publicity or self-publishing, but it was just, I had an idea, and I decided to run with it.
Gosh. And what did you actually do to then sort of make it happen?
Okay, so I was in the process of buying a flat, but I didn't complete on the sale, so I'd saved up to about £10,000, and I took the deposit of the flat, and I put it all into self-publishing. So I found a printer in Northampton, because it was random. It was, you know, I had no links to Northampton. Nobody could trace the P.O. box number. I sat with a printer. I designed the book. The process that goes with, you know, putting a book together, which is from selecting the type of page you want to the print design to all of that. And then that cost about £9,000 for 3,000 copies of Gypsy Masala. And then I realized early on that I needed good PR, good publicity, but there's very little that you can get for £1,000, as in, you know, a long-standing campaign. And because I was going to the library and reading up about, you know, how to do a good PR campaign, and I joined a publicity circle to find out how to do it, I sat one day and I thought, I am going to have to do this myself.
Wow. And so I just want to pause because I want to kind of go back to the sort of specific details, because I think that this will be very interesting for other writers who are potentially thinking of doing the same thing. You designed the book cover and the book pages yourself.
Yes.
And how did you learn to do that?
I don't know. It's just trial and error, to be honest with you. It's really bizarre, but I got a piece. It was just, I had an idea in my mind of what I wanted the cover to look like. Simple, elegant, I looked at bookshops and I thought, no, it's all very complex. I need a different size. I needed a pocket size, a women could put in their handbags. So it was a different size. It was a different feel. But I also needed it to feel quite rich and evocative and something ethnic about it. And I would go to, like, ribbon shops, Indian shops, and pick up different materials and look at, how the material would translate as a book cover. And that's how I did it, with no knowledge, with no expertise, but just going with the way I wanted it to feel.
And you did the deal with the printer, the publisher, yourself? I suppose they weren't publishers, or were they just printers?
No, they were just printers. I was a publisher, so I set up a publishing company called Ninefish to put the whole, to do the books through Ninefish, so it wouldn't look like I had self-published.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you've done all that, and now you've decided you need to do the publicity yourself.
Yes, because I had no money, and I had, well, not no money, but I couldn't do it just for £1,000, and I knew I couldn't do it for £1,000.
Right. Okay, so now, how did you go about doing that?
I sat in the library one day and I thought, I can't call up journalists and say, hi, I'm Preeti Nair, and I have a phenomenal novel by Preeti Nair, because it would sound ridiculous. Nobody hypes their own books and would have no credibility. And also, believe it or not, I'm not now, but I was incredibly, incredibly shy, hated rejection, hated criticism, and just the thought of doing that just sent me into absolute angst and panic. So I came up with this name. I just found myself in the library writing a name, and the name was Prue, and it's because my brother calls me Prue, and Menon. I wrote the name Menon, and that's my mother's maiden name. And I looked at this name, and I thought, if I were to become a publicist, or if I were to have the ideal publicist, what qualities and characteristics would I love her to have? And I just found myself listing these qualities, like, everything that I wasn't. So feisty, fearless of rejection, would not take no for an answer, outgoing, exuberant, all these adjectives just kind of came pouring out. And I looked at it, and I'm not just going to say, yeah, I thought, yes, that's me, I'm going to be her, because that would be, it took a good 4 or 5 months to absolutely be her, get it down to a slick operation, to be able to become the publicist. So before I did that, I set up another company, which was called The Creative House, and it was a multinational. It was made to look like a multinational. It was basically in my back bedroom. And that's why it was called The Creative House, because it was literally a back bedroom. And then I just set about getting the infrastructure for 2 people, so 2 phone lines, 2 fax machines, 2 email addresses. And then I shamelessly began to hype the novel under The Creative House, but Prue did it.
And what was your first, can you remember your first phone call or your first letter?
Oh,
first call?
God, absolutely. To be honest with you, I couldn't get past hello. So I remember calling up a journalist, and it wasn't from one of the big papers. It was quite a simple publication. So I did what I did was I found out all about PR, all about writing good press releases, targeting various magazines and newspapers and radio stations according to the story that would be appropriate to them. So, say, for example, if you look at the book, it has a travel angle. It's set in Kerala and Goa. So I would focus on travel magazines. Or it has a woman's angle, so I would focus on women's magazines. So my first call wasn't even a highbrow publication, but I couldn't get past hello. So the woman, I got through, put through to the editor, and I said, she said hello, and I just put the phone down. I'm like I say, I'm not going to make out that it was like, I got it down after a week or so. It took months and months and months of just getting past my own angst, my own fear of rejection, my own criticisms, and finding a way to do that. And the way I did that was I gave Prue a completely different persona. I changed voices. I sort of distanced myself in that way. Having said that, that makes it sound like I was completely detached and from the situation, but I wasn't, because when I heard things, like awful things about the book, I did kind of crumble into a heap, and I did kind of take it very, very personally. Mm-hmm. But then I had all this riding on it, because I hadn't told anyone. I hadn't told my family that I was self-publishing. I hadn't told my friends I was self-publishing.
So over a period of 3 to 4 months, you were living this double life, setting up these companies, doing these incredibly courageous, brave, some might say foolhardy things in this new persona, all alone.
Yes. And I look back and I think, why did I do that? And I struggle with this sometimes. Why did I do it? But I think when you come up with a bizarre, crazy idea and you share it, you dissipate the energy by talking about it. Whereas if you just go on and do it, and you know it's stupid and you know it's crazy, but you just do it anyway, that comes with a certain amount of momentum and energy. Whereas if you say, if I had said to my best friend, you know what, I've given up work as a management consultant and I'm publishing my own book and I'm becoming this other woman, they would have just said, you know, please either go and see a doctor or, you know, really think twice about it. And I was always riddled with self-doubt. I'm not this confident person. I would have stopped. I would have stopped straight away.
And the people who would have said to you, you're crazy, don't do it, you won't succeed. I mean, I've never heard, you know, that sort of thing would then feed into and tap into that self-doubt and anxiety. And affirm that. And so by doing it alone, although to me it just seems, wow, gosh, how did you sustain it over that time? By doing it alone, you were able to kind of block out the naysayers.
Yes.
When you got through to these people as Prue, and you finally overcame the anxiety and you got past hello, and you were then, as Prue, able to say, this is a fabulous book and it's perfect, you know, for your publication or whatever. What kind of reaction did you get? Will people go, oh yeah, not interested?
Yeah, and that's quite expected, because if you think journalists receive hundreds and hundreds of novels, manuscripts every week, and what makes yours different? What defines yours? So yes, you get no, but you have to learn to move past that no and turn it into a yes. Persistently, so it's either giving them the angle, or giving them the story, or giving them the soundbite, or, you know, and it was a question of just, I would probably make 70, 80 calls a day. I would probably get, you know, 69 no's, but one person would say yes, and I would hang on. Any way that I could hang on to a yes or an ounce of positivity, I would turn it into a big thing. I would see that one person thinks this, and I would hold on to that.
And so that then drove, so once you got your first yes, you were hopefully more able then to get more yeses, because you were focusing on that. And I got yes once, I'm going to get yes again.
Yes.
And so on. Okay.
It's possible. I saw possibility.
Yeah. All right. So you started then getting interest from the publicity angle. Where was the book or the 3,000 copies in all this time?
Okay. So the launch date was in March, and we're talking about books need 8 weeks to be sewn, printed, bound. And these are 8 weeks or longer. I'm kind of drumming up publicity. And so they're stocked at the printers, which is in Northampton. So I drive up to Northampton to get 500 copies or so for press, so I could send them out to press. And I realized pretty early on, I can't just suddenly turn up to the house with 500 copies of Gypsy Masala, because I'm supposed to be a management consultant. And in the whole time when all of this activity was going on, because I was working from home, I told my parents that I was going freelance, and that, you know, and my father was still very concerned that I was still a management consultant, and I had said yes. But I've also been picked up by a very small publisher called Ninefish, which, okay, it was a lie, but it wasn't that far from the truth. So I'd gone to collect these books, and I told them, you know, I'm going to Northampton to see my publishers to collect the books. And unbeknownst to me, I mean, okay, so I was driving down from Northampton with these books, feeling absolutely elated, happy. I mean, it truly, truly felt that I was following a dream, and it truly felt that this was the absolute right path to be going down. And then for some reason, I couldn't get into the house because the drive was all blocked with all these various different cars. So I walked in, and to my horror, the house was filled with people, like friends and family. And because my parents were so proud of the fact that I'd been picked up by a publisher, they wanted to celebrate the fact, so hence had invited friends and family around. And it was at that moment my heart just sank, because I thought, oh my God, I've turned into someone who deceives. And then a second thing happened to me. So I got past that whole angst of this sinking feeling. And this thought came into my head, and it was a very, very random thought. It was, okay, so go upstairs and look at page 179. And it was so bizarre, I don't normally hear voices in my head. So I took a copy of the book upstairs, I looked at page 179, and it was totally and utterly blank. It began chapter 13, but it was blank. And the thing is, when you self-publish, it's down to you to check proofs, to check copy, to check everything. And if there is an error, like a page missing, or a, you know, that you haven't spotted, that's your liability. And so I sat there in my room with a with a house full of people downstairs, and I just thought, oh my God, that's £9,000 down the drain. Forget the money. Yeah. Think of the deceit. Think of not having the job. And I just didn't know what to do. And I contained myself. I went downstairs. I saw to all my guests. They left. I went back upstairs, tried to get a hold of the printer, but I couldn't because it was a Saturday, and I just started to sob. I just sobbed because I couldn't handle it. I could not handle the pressure anymore. So sobbed all of Saturday, sobbed all of Sunday, and then Monday first thing, managed to get hold of my printer Steve, and I said to him, please, please, please tell me that this is not my fault, because I remember, I knew all this. I mean, I knew about printer liability, and I had it all explained to me, so I knew I checked these proofs at least 10 times, and I said, please tell me that this is not my fault. And he said to me, it's my error, I missed a printing plate. And I said, okay, that's fine. Just make sure that I get at least 500 copies couriered down to me by, you know, by the end of the week, you know, so I can send them out to press. And he said, you know that I can't do that. And I said, why can't you do that? And he said, because these books take 8 weeks to print and bind, and so there is no way I can get books printed. I can get them printed, like, but I can't get them sewn, glued, blah blah blah, in like the space of a couple of days. And I sat there thinking, and I was thinking, but you don't understand, this is like 8 weeks of, not even 8 weeks, it's longer, it's like 3 months or longer of publicity that I have lined up. And the thing with publicity and journalists is they're not really bothered about your logistical problems. If a product doesn't arrive when you say that it's going to arrive, they move on to the next thing. So I thought my key priority is to get these books out. And anyway, went backwards and forwards, and he said there was absolutely no way. So I had another brainwave, and I said, okay, you can print me copies, single-page copies, can't you? And I said, and he said, yes. And I said, print me at least 1,000 pages and courier them over to me. And that is what I spent the next couple of days doing. I sat, literally sat in the middle of the night, because by day I was supposed to be a management consultant, and I started print-sticking copies of page 179 into Gypsy Masala.
It's unbelievable your amazing tenacity and creativity in the face.
It's not really though, because I had so much to lose. I had to make it work.
Yes. So you glued all these pages together and you sent them off to your journalist.
Yeah, well, I sent 500 copies out to journalists randomly, and then I was sat on at least 500 more books. I mean, for, you know, at least 500 copies. And I was sitting there thinking, oh, my God, I've got 2,500 books or 2,000 books at the warehouse that I clearly cannot sell, because you cannot sell defective books. What am I going to do with them? And above my desk back at the Creative House, there was a huge notice board pinned with random various ideas and strategies. And on one of them was the publicity directory. I'd gone to join the PPC, which is a publicity circle in London, to learn how to become a publicist. And there was a directory in there, and on the back of the directory was an advertisement, you know, advertising the London Book Fair in London, which was happening, bearing in mind where Wednesday was happening, that Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday of that week. And so I thought, maybe I'm meant to be at the London Book Fair and giving out my books. So I called up the lady who was organising the London Book Fair, and I said, oh, I'd like to come, and blah, blah, blah. And she said yes, for next year. And I said, no, for the end of this week. And she just basically laughed, and she said, you know what, it takes over a year to organise this. All the stands have been taken. Call back, you know, next year. And I said, no, but please take my number just in case you have a cancellation. And she said, no, we never have cancellations because blah, 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 blah. It takes a lot to organize, and the stands are like gold dust and whatever. Anyway, so I gave her my number, and 20 minutes later, she calls me back, and she says, you're not going to believe this, Miss Nye, but we've just had a cancellation, but not any cancellation. It's for small press, which is what I am, like, clearly, small pack press. And she said, I can give it to you at the third of the cost because cancellation fee covers the rest of it. Would you like to come? And I was like, I was just jumping up and down and trying to say calmly, yes, thank you. And I put the phone down, and then I thought, oh, I've got a logistical problem because I can't go as Prue, the creative director and the publicity director of the Creative House. I can't go as the editorial director of Nine Fish and as the author. And as, you know, the various people that I'd invented. So I thought, I need some bodies. I need my friends. So I kind of chose two friends on the basis of who I thought would make a good PR person and who I thought could talk a good editorial, kind of could do the editorial job. And I invited them around for dinner. And I sat with my two friends, and I said, I'm going to tell you a story. Now, just bear with me with this story. And I sat and I explained from the very beginning. I told them what I'd been doing, blah, blah, blah. And they just sat there gobsmacked. And I said, at the end of it, I said, so you, Teresa, are going to be my PR person, and you, Avni, are going to be my editorial. And any questions, you just field them to me. It will be fine. But the main purpose of going to London Book Fair is just to go give out books and have fun. And they just thought they would come along to humour me. They thought it was a mad, crazy idea. But they just wanted to come, A, to help me, and B, to humour me.
Yes,
so
great.
We went to the London Book Fair, and we had the most fun, because where big publishers like HarperCollins, Pam Macmillan, Picador, they were giving out leaflets, we were giving out books. And everyone was going, publishing is so small, everyone knows each other. They were all going, who is Nine Fish? Who is, where has this woman come from? Do you know? Mm. And at the London Book Fair, we made loads and loads and loads of contacts who were to prove very, very useful later on.
Mm-hmm. And then how did you get the books actually physically into the bookshop?
Okay. So this is another huge oversight, because when you're just going on a journey, you learn, and God, the learning curve was quite steep. So I was in between doing the London Book Fair. I was doing all the publicity that I had set up as well. And I remember being on Julia Somerville's show. She did a program called LBC, which is a London program. And she asked me at the end of the interview, she said, so Preeti, where can we get a hold of copies of Gypsy Masala? And it's going to sound so incredibly naive or such an oversight, but I had overlooked the entire distribution network, and there were no books in shops. I mean, having said that, that's not strictly true, because I had them at distributors. I had managed to secure two main distributors, which were Bertrams and Gardeners, yes, which was a huge, feat in itself. But what I didn't understand, that bestsellers are made, so publishing houses decide on their lead titles, like, 12 to 18 months beforehand, and they decide what publicity budget is going into what book based on what advance has been paid to the author. And then they have a whole team of sales reps that go around the country into bookshops saying, this is our lead title, you should buy X amount, and then they go and buy up window space, they buy up 3-for-2 deals. Now, if you're starting out, if you're a small publisher, you've got no hope. You don't know any of this. So just by the mere fact that I had them in distributors, I thought that they would automatically go out to bookshops. But it wasn't the case. And I realized pretty early on that I needed a sales team, and I didn't have a sales team. So a sales team to say, you know, stock this book, to go into every single bookshop in London or every single bookshop in the country, say, stock this book because it's going to be huge. So back to the question Julia Somerville asked me, so where can we get hold of copies of Gypsy Masala? I just took a huge, deep breath, and I said, in all good bookshops. And then I rushed back home thinking, oh, my God, distribution. So armed with a travel card and, like, a door-to-door salesperson, bearing in mind that what I feared most of all was criticism and rejection, I had to put myself in that situation. And I went to every single bookshop that I could find in London, which was about probably about 200 plus in the space of 2 weeks, and said, I'm Preeti Nair, please stop my book. You don't know who I am, but I promise in 2 years' time you'll know who I am. And a lot of the bookshop managers looked at me like I was some lunatic, because authors don't do that. And a few of them actually placed orders.
Hmm. And so you, again, I think this is the part that most authors listening to this will be kind of shrinking into their, you know, cubbyhole and blanching at the thought of doing this. But so you go around, or you went around with a briefcase full of books?
I mean, initially it was like, you know, it was just a big bag full of books. Hmm.
And did you make appointments, or you just turned up?
No, I just turned up. You can't really make appointments.
And you asked to see the manager?
Yeah.
And you did your little spiel?
Yes.
And they would either look you in the eye and say, go away, or they might hope, and a few did. And it must have been horrible to actually physically be there while they're saying, go away.
Not go away in those terms, but thank you, but no thank you. Or they would take the book, and you so knew that they weren't going to read them because it would, you knew it was going to go under the counter. Just a feeling. They would never say blatantly, you know, just go away. Mm. But there was ways of doing it. But you know how I say I just clung on to the positivity or the bits of things that happened to me that were so incredibly positive? Mm. I was doing a sales pitch in Waterstones on Tottenham Court Road, and these two men were just looking at me and laughing. And I was just doing it, and you know, and at the end of it, they came up to me and they were saying, you know what, Preeti, that was damn good. And they were two big sales reps. They were sales reps. One was from Time Warner, and the other one was from HarperCollins. And what they did subsequently was they went around to every single bookshop in the area, and they said, there's this woman who's going to come in, and she's called Preeti Nair, and she's got a book called Gypsy Masala. You have to stock it. And so I would go into bookshops subsequently, and they would be expecting me because these two sales reps from these companies had gone in.
Wow. And it's almost like the universe was really helping you because you had kind of synchronized yourself with it and you were meeting your destiny.
Sort of. I think, you know what, you come out of your comfort zone, you take one leap of faith or one step towards your goal or your dream, and things do seem to conspire to help you along the way.
Mm-hmm. And so you got your books into some of the bookshops in London.
Yes, and then what happened? Something quite phenomenal happened. So I'm back at the Creative House. I'm also doing all the sales, all the invoicing, all the, you know, I don't send the books out physically, but I get the printers in Northampton to send the books out. And in one bookshop, it's doing huge amounts of volume. So it's Finchley Road. It's doing at least 500 copies a week. And get to the end of the month, it's done like 2,000 copies.
Wow.
Bearing in mind, you know, my initial print run is 3,000, but the printer printed an extra 3,000 to make up for his original mistake. Mm. Did he? I can't remember, was it 3,000 or 6,000? But he printed a whole amount of volume to make up for his mistake. So bearing in mind, that was like virtually, you know, a third of my print run in one shop. So I decided to visit the shop to see what was happening. And I walked in, and there was Gypsy Masala in at number two of the bestseller charts of books, etc. And I just couldn't stop staring at it because I thought, have they put it there? Because it was a small, dinky book and, you know, had nowhere else to put it. And because I just, like, was just standing there for what seemed to be hours. The store manager came over and she said, are you Preeti? And I said, yes. And she said, that is our fastest-selling title. It's outselling The Orange, The Booker, and we can't get enough of it. And not only that, we're thinking of replicating the success to, you know, our 28 branches.
My goodness. So you, really, your belief in the book was finally vindicated.
Sort of, because then I had more obstacles to face before that. Okay, so bearing in mind that it takes at least 8 weeks to print and bind these books, and I only have 6,000 copies left, and it's doing huge amount of volumes, and there are 28 branches, I'm thinking, do the math, print more books. So I take a huge loan out to cover the cost to print more books, because I think, you know what, you have to strike while the iron's hot. So without a firm commitment, you know, that these books were going to be stocked by the sales director or the marketing director, and I'm waiting for the call, and it doesn't seem to materialize. And then I get panicky, and I start stalking the marketing director and, you know, trying to get books in. But it wasn't in terms of volume. It wasn't the volume that I'd expected. So it was like bits and pieces. Do you see what I mean? It wasn't like... And I was thinking, oh, my God, I've now got even more books that I have to move. And it just wasn't happening. And at the same time, around about the same time, someone had called the Prue line, and I picked it up, and I said, you know, Prue Men on Creative House, and the person at the other end said, it's really Prue, is it? And I said, yes. And I was kind of quivering because I thought, oh, God, who is this? And the person on the other end said, it's Preethi, isn't it? And basically he was a journalist from the Sunday Express who was running a double life story on me for that Sunday, and he asked me if I had anything to comment. And I quickly put the phone down. I said, no comment, put the phone down. Because I was thinking, oh my God, my mum and dad, they don't even know about this story. Nobody knows about this story. I don't want it to be in the Sunday Express. And I just had this image of a sleazy double life story coming out, which was so far removed from the truth. And then I thought about it. I said, I've got enormous volume of books that need to be moved. And if the story came out positively, then maybe other media would pick up on it, and then, you know, that's how it works. Mm. And, you know, the books would go, and it would all come good in the end. So I called up the journalist and I said, I'm really sorry about that. Be really happy to do the interview with you. So I went up to Canary Wharf, felt it was going to be a positive interview, and then it was going to come out on Sunday. It took me the whole week until Saturday evening to bring myself to the point where I could tell my parents. Mm. And they near enough did it whilst they were asleep, so I have to explain it to them. Anyway, I don't want to digress and tell you what happened by telling my parents, but true to form, the article did come out. But it came out, and other press did pick up on it, but it came out, you're not going to remember this, but in 2001 there was a four-day petrol crisis, and you could not get petrol for love nor money. Goods could not be transported. Nothing could be transported. So the books remained in the warehouse, and I had this huge momentum for publicity, but no books in the bookshops, which is a huge deal, because how it works is you as a consumer, you read an article which you're semi-aware of. You see the books that are in the bookshops. You associate article with book, and then you pick up book. But if there's no book in the shops, and you've taken the trouble to write down the title, and this is pre-Amazon days, well, before Amazon was as big as it is today, if you've taken the trouble to write it down, then the likelihood of you coming back twice is highly unlikely, and you've lost the sale. So basically, to cut a very, very long story short, I was left with momentum that had passed me by, a huge, huge amount of debt, and with nowhere to go apart from, you know, just thinking, oh my God, is this what happens when you follow a dream?
There must be a silver lining, surely. You can't end the story there, Preethi.
Oh, I wish I could. No, I don't wish I could. What happened then was, I think I was at my lowest point of, you know, God, if I could have driven those lorries myself, if I could have done anything more, I would have. But I had to accept that it was my fate not to become a novelist, and at some point I had to accept and let go. But before I did that, I made a call, and it was a random call. It was bizarre. It was at the London Book Fair that I was telling you about. I met a group of ladies who were the calendar women, and they had posed naked for a WI calendar, which they had self-published, and it had gone global. It was a global phenomenon. And one of the ladies said to me, if you ever, ever need any help in anything, just get in touch. And I was at my lowest point, and I was looking at this calendar, and I thought, who can I call? And I just called one of the ladies up, and I just burst into tears. Mm-hmm. And I just, because I had not spoken to anyone about it. I was in so much angst. I just cried and cried and cried. And she said, okay, now this is what you need to do. Just calmly talk me through this scenario. So I told her the whole story, and she told me two things. She said, come up to Yorkshire for whatever length of time you want to, because they were going to America to promote their calendar, and the cottages were going to be free. And so she said, just come up and don't just jump into your next decision. Don't just say, you know, go to work because I've got nothing better to, you know, I have to pay off my debts, I have to go to work. Mm. But think about it. And the second thing is that she said, I think you need professional advice. So if you decide to come up to Yorkshire, go up to Bedfordshire before you come to Yorkshire and see my agent, Diana. And I put the phone down. I thought, you know what, 6 weeks in the scheme of things, what do I have to lose? Mm. You know, what do I have to lose? So I went up to Bedfordshire to see Trisha's agent, Diana Holmes. And I went to see Diana, and Diana said, oh, yes, I've heard all about you, and I've heard all about the story. I have two pieces of advice to give to you. And the first piece of advice is let go. Let go of everything that has gone before, as in let go of Gypsy Masala, let go of the fact that, you know, nothing came to it, that 2 years of your life was spent dedicated to that book. Let go. Nothing is going to happen. Just let go of that. And once you've accepted that, you're able to move on. Should you wish to write, write truthfully, write honestly, and write about something that you are totally passionate about. And I kind of told her a bit about my family story, and she said, fictionalize it. Mm. So I went off to Yorkshire with no hopes, no expectations, but just to get rid of my angst. And I did that through writing and fictionalizing my own family story. Mm. And I would email the pages down to Diana, and Diana would, after the end of every day, she would just say, write more, write more. And it was the first time I ever had a reader or someone who was encouraging me. And at the end of the 6 weeks, because I stayed up in Yorkshire for 6 weeks, I completed my second manuscript, 100 Shades of White.
Mm, wow.
I then drove down to Bedfordshire, handed her the manuscript, and she said, okay, go back to work now. I didn't hand it in thinking, you know what, I'm going to be published. It was with no expectation. I mean, that's not strictly true. It's not without expectation, but it wasn't with huge expectations. Mm-hmm. And so I was in the process of putting my CV together, sending out, my CV to various companies, researching companies where I'd like to work. And Diana phoned me up, and she said, are you sitting down? She said, I have various publishers interested in 100 Shades of White, and they'd like to meet you. So I went around to meet various publishers, which I didn't realize was a big deal at the time. And so I went around to meet them. And I was sitting in HarperCollins, and it was quite hilarious because I met the sales director, the marketing director, the editor, but I had met them all under various guises of Prue. So we'd sat there, and they kind of found the humor in it.
Mm.
And also, I was telling you about the sales rep. Mm. He was from HarperCollins, mm. So I kind of took it as a little bit of a sign. I felt very comfortable with HarperCollins, and they were going to republish and reissue Gypsy Masala at a later stage. And so they offered me a 3-book deal,
oh, wow.
Which
fabulous.
I almost keeled over. I had written two novels by that stage. So I'd written 100 Shades of White and Gypsy Masala, so I only had to write one more as part of my 3-book deal. So I signed my 3-book deal with HarperCollins, and then shortly after that, the BBC bought the rights to 100 Shades of White for a drama on BBC One next year.
Oh, wow, how exciting.
Yes. And the biggest irony was, one of the biggest irony, because there are many ironies in this story, but Prue, my publicist, was shortlisted as publicist of the year because of the phenomenal job she had done on promoting Gypsy Masala. And the irony is, the lady who, I didn't win that year, but the lady who ended up winning that year is now my publicist at HarperCollins.
Well, you only need the second best. Well, that is such a wonderful story. Just to wrap up now, what qualities do you think you discovered in yourself during this whole experience? And do you think your background in business helped you handle all the business aspects?
Absolutely. Okay, qualities, perseverance, self-belief. I mean, I never realized how much self-belief I had. The fear of criticism, the fear of rejection. I'm not saying I've overcome all those things, but I can manage them a lot better than I could, say, 7 years ago. Determination, a lot more knowledge and understanding of systems and how things work in the world. I think I was a lot more naive. But it's like I'm saying to you, when you... The other biggest irony is I'd written Gypsy Masala. It was a story about following your dreams and following your passion and going to wherever that may want to take you, but also confronting your fears. And you realize, and it is the biggest cliche, but it is not necessarily the destination. It is the journey. It is the things that you learn. It is the people that you meet along the way and the things that shape you and form you and make you evolve as a person.
And how does your experience now at HarperCollins compare to the days when you were your own publisher?
I'm not going to say it's been a slick transition, because it has been incredibly, incredibly difficult at times for me. At times, I mean, you have to go from being in total control of your work, as I was a self-publishing, like through to cover design, through to editing. I did it all myself. I had nobody telling me what to do or how to do it or what works, or to going from that to having it almost taken out of your hands. So the story or the essence of the story will always be the same. I mean, I have brilliant editors. I never have a problem with that. But I have a problem when it goes out of my hands, where marketing people get involved and it becomes about marketing trends and they put covers on that you're not entirely happy with, but you don't have that much say because then, you know, you have that threat of your marketing and PR budget being pulled. All those issues I've had to deal with.
And so it's different challenges, because it's...
Absolutely, and that's what I mean. Just because you reach your final destination, it's a beginning of another journey and another process of learning and another process of evolving and another set of challenges.
Mm-hmm. So finally, what is your advice to writers who may be thinking of self-publishing?
Don't do it. Here's the thing, okay, self-publishing has moved on so much in 7 years with the internet, with print on demand, that I'm not exactly the best person to speak to about self-publishing, in terms of when I first did it, it was like an all or nothing, print 3,000 books, go for it, you know, do it wholeheartedly. But now I understand you can print a couple of hundred books. You can even print one book, print on demand. You can do wonderful things through the internet. So it doesn't have to be an all or nothing thing. So it is an option, but I would say it should be a final option. It should be after all considered routes, like getting an agent, all those routes have been explored, and if nothing comes of it, then yes, self-publish.
I think you're right about the sort of technology has changed in that, you know, you can print, you don't have to have to stock 3,000 books, and you don't have those kinds of problems. But I think in terms of all the rest of that chain that gets it into the bookshops, the publicity that you need to do, the networking.
But I think that's also changed. So if you look at technology and you look at like sites like YouTube and MySpace, and you look at the power that goes through word of mouth through that has also evolved. You know, it's like it's not necessarily like the chains of distribution that have originally existed are the only chains of all methods of distribution. So, you know, to underestimate the power of internet, and I think this is where a lot of the publishing houses are going to fall behind, because if they do underestimate the power of technology and the power of the internet, they will inevitably fall behind, because it does have tremendous power and word of mouth.
So in a way, that opens up some venues for the kind of do-it-yourself networking and publicity, which is much more easily done. Just for example, like blogging, I wouldn't have been able to do that a few years ago, but it's much easier now, and so that is an option for publicity, and there's YouTube, and a lot of people are much more comfortable with Amazon, so you can buy books quite easily and so on.
Absolutely. So you've eliminated that need for distribution, the need to be, I mean, it's great to have a presence in bookshops, don't get me wrong, but you've eliminated that absolute, well, when I was starting out, you absolutely fundamentally needed to be in bookshops, or you needed to have a good distribution outlet, which is not so much the case today.
Mm. Great. Prithi Nayar, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Prithi Nayar, author of Gypsy Masala. To find out more about Prithi and her books, go to www.prithinayar.com. To find out more about my article on the writer as entrepreneur for Mislexia, the journal for women writers, go to www.mislexia.co.uk, and that's spelt M-S-L-E-X-I-A, mislexia.co.uk, and click on the link to magazine. To find out more about my article on the writer as entrepreneur for Mislexia, the journal for women writers, go to www.mislexia.co.uk, and that's spelt M-S-L-E-X-I-A, mislexia.co.uk, and click on the link to magazine. To read the other interviews with self-published writers Julie Noble and Mark Blaney and book publishing insider Scott Pack, go to my blog at www.fusionview.co.uk and click on the category Writer as Entrepreneur. Thanks for listening. See you next time.